From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the death of Yasser Arafat, his likely successor, and the prospects for peace in the Middle East. We talk with James Bennett. After 3 years as the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief, he returned to the U.S. over the summer. Now he's back in the Middle East, where he's covered Arafat's funeral and the aftermath of his death. Bennett has been traveling through the West Bank and Gaza. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Universal United House of Prayer, the new solo CD by Buddy Miller. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has nominated two more key officials as he prepares for his second term. The president named his domestic policy advisor, Margaret Spellings, to replace Rod Page as Secretary of Education.
America's children, teachers, and parents will have a principled, determined ally in my cabinet. She is my complete trust. And she will be an outstanding Secretary of Education.
Like Page, Spellings is a Texan, and she served as President Bush's education advisor when he was governor of Texas. She helped develop the policy that became the No Child Left Behind Act.
Our schools must keep their promise to all our children, and I pledge to do all I can to ensure that no child is left behind.
President Bush has also named Deputy White House Chief of Staff Harriet Myers to replace Alberto Gonzalez as White House counsel. A suicide car bomber attacked a U.S. military convoy in Iraq today, leaving at least 10 people dead and 9 others wounded. Hospital officials in the northern oil town of Beji say that all the dead were Iraqis. NPR's Philip Reeves reports from Baghdad.
There's been trouble for several days in the Sunni town of Beji, with clashes between insurgents and U.S. and Iraqi forces. Witnesses reportedly say the suicide car bomber rammed his car into a U.S. armored vehicle and blew himself up in a market area. There were clashes also in Ramadi, west of Fallujah, where insurgents were once again on the streets, exchanging fire with U.S. troops. U.S. warplanes reportedly bombed an industrial area on the city's eastern edge. Philip Reeves, NPR News, Baghdad.
Fighting continued today in Fallujah as U.S. Marines and soldiers hunted rebels, some of whom reportedly re-infiltrated areas that were captured early in the assault. U.S. artillery pounded some buildings where rebels were believed to be holding out. Congressional Democrats say the Food and Drug Administration contributed to this year's shortage of flu vaccine. California Democrat Henry Waxman said the agency failed to follow up on problems uncovered at a British vaccine plant last year. Waxman says the FDA accepted false assurances from the U.S. owner of the plant, Chiron Corporation, as NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Waxman said that documents provided by the FDA show that the agency knew that there were potentially serious contaminations at the plant as long ago as 2003, and that their failure to make sure that those problems were corrected helped lead to this year's closure of the plant and the loss of half of the U.S. flu vaccine supply for this winter.
NPR's Julie Rovner. Lester Crawford, the FDA's acting commissioner, says the problems last year were not related to contamination in this year's batch of vaccine. In stocks, the Dow gained 62 to close at 10,549. The Nasdaq was up 21 to 2099. This is NPR News. Republicans in the House of Representatives have approved a change in their rules, which would allow Majority Leader Tom DeLay of Texas to keep his leadership job if he's indicted. There's no indication that DeLay will be indicted in a grand jury probe of corruption related to the 2002 legislative elections. A grand jury in Austin has indicted three of DeLay's political associates. DeLay has charged that the investigation is a politically motivated attack by Democrats. A federal judge in Utah is asking President Bush to commute a mandatory sentence the judge imposed yesterday, saying federal law forced an unjust punishment. The judge is also asking Congress to respond. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
U.S. District Judge Paul Cassell says minimum mandatory sentencing requirements forced him to level a sentence he describes as cruel, unjust, and irrational. Cassell wants President Bush to commute that sentence to a shorter term and he wants Congress to revise the mandatory sentencing law that applies. The case involves money laundering, weapons possession, and drug trafficking convictions for a 25-year-old first offender. Cassell writes that an 18-year sentence is appropriate, but the firearms violations trigger a minimum prison term of 55 years. Cassell worries that Congress will enact similar minimum mandatory provisions if the Supreme Court strikes down federal sentencing guidelines in response to two other cases. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Retail prices rose sharply last month, in part because of a big jump in energy costs. The Labor Department said its consumer price index gained 0.6% in October. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Buffalo Niagara Enterprise, point of contact for business expansion in tourism, logistics, customer service, and manufacturing in Western New York. BuffaloNiagara.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The death of Yasser Arafat marks the end of an era. Palestinians will vote for a new head of the Palestinian Authority in an election now scheduled for January 9th. We're going to talk about the death of Arafat and what it may mean for peace in the Middle East and the creation of a Palestinian state. My guest, James Bennett, was the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief for 3 years. He left the post over the summer and is now a correspondent in the Washington Bureau. But he returned to the Middle East to cover the death of Arafat and its aftermath. This morning, he went to a studio in Jerusalem to record our interview. Did you expect that it would end quite this way for Arafat?
No, I don't think anybody expected it to end this way or so quickly. He'd been sick, and we were sort of used to rumors of Yasser Arafat being sick. A year ago, we went through a bout like this. There were rumors even that he was on his deathbed, that he had stomach cancer. It turned out, at least at the time, we thought to be a bad case of the flu, and he bounced right back. He looked very pale, but we all attributed that to his incarceration, virtual incarceration, confinement at least, in the ruined compound in Ramallah, the Mukatta. But obviously he was much more sick all along.
Do you know why there's been so much mystery surrounding the actual cause of his death?
No. Rumors are rampant, of course, here and throughout the Arab world now. The speculation has obviously been fed by the fact that no information has been released. The man died of an undisclosed illness. Under French law, it seems, his wife has the final say over whether any information is going to be released. The Palestinian leadership has now called on the French to start putting out some information about it, and hopefully we'll get some clarity in the coming days.
And there's also the issue of the money that Arafat had a lot of, millions of dollars apparently, stashed away someplace, and nobody knows where it is.
He's said to. Again, there's a lot of bad information out there about this right now, and not a lot is known. But he obviously lived very simply himself. His wife, Suha Arafat, lived rather more grandly in Paris over the last few years. She wasn't in Ramallah during the course of the conflict with Israel. For the last four years, she wasn't seen here with their daughter. Some of the money went to her. There were PLO investments made all over the world in things like cellular telephone networks and other sorts of enterprises. A lot of those were money-losing operations. The Israeli officials say there was also money parked in various accounts that Yasser Arafat maintained control of, and that's money that they're trying to track down now.
You've been traveling around the West Bank and Gaza. Are people in mourning for Yasser Arafat? What are the visible signs of that mourning?
The visible signs are things like posters that have appeared all over the West Bank in little towns like Qalqilia, big cities like Nablus, also in Gaza City. People are stringing black cloths from their car antennas, things like that. Murals of Yasser Arafat have been freshly painted on the walls of stores and other buildings throughout the territories. Those are the tangible signs, I guess. There was obviously a tremendous outpouring of grief around the time of his funeral itself. But it has to be said that life is also going forward. It's not as though people have stopped what they're doing completely. Yasser Arafat's death coincided with the end of Ramadan, the holiday period known as the Eid. It interfered, I would say, with business, which usually booms during the course of the Eid as people buy presents and things like that for one another. But the holiday nevertheless went forward, and there's a mourning period that's still underway in the territories, but businesses are open again. The streets are busy in Gaza City, and people are going on with their lives.
My impression is that there were mixed feelings among Palestinians about Arafat. He was a great symbol of the Palestinian resistance. But my impression is he wasn't admired for the way he ran the Palestinian Authority. There was a lot of corruption, mismanagement. Are there mixed feelings about Arafat and his legacy?
Well, I think you put it very well. There was real frustration with the governance, Palestinian governance in the territories, and the Palestinian Authority, which was created by the Oslo Accords, brought Yasser Arafat back to the territories from exile. He became president of the Palestinian Authority, but there was tremendous unrest with his management of it, with the corruption, the mismanagement that was really rampant. And some Palestinians say that one reason Yasser Arafat was comfortable with this intifada, if he didn't start it, that he at least encouraged it, certainly abided it, was because otherwise he feared an intifada against his own rule in the territories because the frustration was so great. And he was very happy to see that deflected toward the Israelis. All that said, however, there's a tremendous reservoir of affection for this man, even when people were irritated with him. They called him the old man. They called him by his nom de guerre, Abu Ammar. They still do. A feeling that people really had of a personal connection with him. And a lot of the anger at the Palestinian Authority was directed at the ministers around Arafat. You'd constantly hear the complaint that it's not Arafat. He doesn't realize what these people are doing, how they're taking advantage of him. He's such a nice guy. That's what you're seeing now, this feeling of real loyalty to him. Because one thing most Palestinians, I think, believe is that Yasser Arafat always had their interests at heart, that he always cared about them. That's not something they feel about these other ministers around him, who they saw lining their own pockets, building nice villas, driving around in fancy cars. Yasser Arafat lived simply, from their point of view. And particularly in the last couple of years, when he was a virtual prisoner of Israel, they felt he was suffering in the same way they were.
Let's talk a little bit about reaction to Arafat's death in Israel. Do you think that Ariel Sharon is hoping that the new president of the PLO will be a partner for peace? Sharon had said that Arafat was not a legitimate peace partner.
I don't doubt that he would hope that the new chairman of the PLO, Mahmoud Abbas, would prove to be a partner for peace. It's not clear that Ariel Sharon's definition of what constitutes a partner for peace could ever be someone who would function effectively as a Palestinian leader. That is, someone who could be popular, be regarded as legitimate as by the Palestinians. Ariel Sharon has set very clear tests for whoever's running the Palestinian leadership for what he wants to see happen before he's willing to negotiate substantively with the Palestinians. It's going to be very difficult for this new guy to pass those tests.
What do you think the new guy, what do you think the likelihood is that the new guy will be Mahmoud Abbas?
Well, he will certainly be the new guy for a while. I think the question is how long he'll last in that capacity. The Palestinian politicians around him, the next generation of Palestinian leadership, is very much thinking of him as an interim figure. I'm not sure if that's how he views himself. He is 69 years old. He's a longtime ally of Yasser Arafat. He was essentially Yasser Arafat's deputy in the PLO. Although he took a very different view of the conflict, he's been a very sharp critic of the Palestinian uprising. He briefly served as the Palestinian prime minister more than a year ago. He lasted 3 or 4 months in the job at this somewhat hopeful moment here as the White House reengaged in the peace process. But he quit after that period, blaming Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat for undermining him.
Well, elections have to be held within 60 days of Arafat's death, and they're now set for January 9th. Who are the likely candidates other than, besides Mahmoud Abbas?
I'd say I'd pause over the have to. They're supposed to be held within 60 days under Palestinian law. The Palestinians say they want to hold them January 9th, but creating the conditions for these elections is going to be very difficult, and I wouldn't be surprised if that date slipped or even changed substantially.
Well, we'll get to that in a second about what are the problems with this election. But who do you think will be likely candidates in addition to Mahmoud Abbas?
We don't know right now. It looks like he may well be the only major party candidate. Some other people will probably put themselves forward as possible rivals, but probably no one with anything like his name recognition. Hamas has said it will not participate in these elections. Islamic Jihad, another militant faction, has said it isn't going to contest the presidency of the Palestinian Authority. Both those groups oppose the Oslo Agreement. They're both officially bent on Israel's destruction. And so to run for this position, they think, would make them complicit in Oslo, force them to accept certain premises that they reject. I think that Mahmoud Abbas, at least right now, he's likely to be the consensus candidate of the dominant faction, Yasser Arafat's old faction, Fatah. There are more popular men within Fatah than Abbas, particularly Marwan Barghouti, who is serving 5 life sentences in Israeli prison right now. Some of Barghouti's loyalists have suggested he might run, but I don't think he will.
Do you think he'll have a lot of influence from prison?
Yeah, and I think the reason that his loyalists have been suggesting he might run, simply to send a signal to Mahmoud Abbas that he's there, he wants his views taken into his account, and he wants his people taken care of in whatever new government is created.
How does he do that? How does he use his power from prison?
Well, he communicates to his supporters. He communicates through his lawyer. Somehow every now and then he manages to get messages out from prison, and he has people that know him quite well who function essentially in his name, particularly in the West Bank.
So what do you think it is that he'll want?
Marwan Barghouti?
Yeah.
We can't be sure. He's played a role, including a year ago in the previous Mahmoud Abbas government. There was briefly a ceasefire brokered among the militant factions. Marwan Barghouti's voice was critical in making that happen. He's been a proponent of the uprising, a leader of it, according to the Israelis. When I interviewed him, he consistently said that he only supported attacks against Israeli soldiers and settlers in the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza. He argued that those were legitimate targets under international law, and he opposed attacks against Israeli civilians inside pre-1967 Israel. The Israelis say that that's not the case, that he was also involved in those sorts of attacks. It would be very interesting if he now raised his voice in an effort to try to restrain the uprising, to limit the attacks to the occupied territories and prevent attacks on Israeli civilians.
Why is he so popular among Palestinians?
Well, it's interesting. He was not that popular before he was arrested. He was very strong in Ramallah area in the southern and central West Bank, where he comes from a very large family. He'd been a student leader at Birzeit University in Ramallah. He is a charismatic figure. He's a little pudgy guy, but he has a kind of presence that made him a very effective speaker. He's quite an eloquent speaker. He speaks English and Hebrew as well as Arabic. So he was very popular in that area. But once the Israelis arrested him, he saw his popularity grow considerably. And one of the conspiracy theories among Palestinians is that Israel was deliberately building him up. The trial was conducted very publicly. Marwan Barghouti was seen raising his manacled hands defiantly over his head, denouncing the Israeli occupation in an Israeli courtroom. And he became a symbol of Palestinian suffering and steadfastness, which is to say he became a symbol very much like Yasser Arafat, not just in the territories, but throughout the Arab world. And that's when he really became a household name.
My guest is James Bennett, former New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief. He's now back in the Middle East. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Bennett. He was the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief for 3 years. He left the position over the summer, but now he's back in the Middle East, where he's been covering Arafat's death and its aftermath. Many people have said that peace would likely never happen with the old leadership in power, with Arafat and Sharon. Arafat is out of the picture now, and Mahmoud Abbas is the new leadership, although this might just be a transitional period. He might not be the leader for a long period of time. Does he represent something new? He's not exactly a new generation. Does he represent anything new?
Well, first, I would say Arafat was an excuse for a lot of people, not just for the Israelis, but also for the Palestinians. He was a reason not to do a lot of things. Whether they're actually going to now do any of these things that they said they couldn't do when Yasser Arafat was there is very much an open question. Mahmoud Abbas is different, very different than Yasser Arafat, in that he opposes the armed struggle. He thinks that the armed struggle has been a disaster for the Palestinians in the world. He is a guy who wears a suit instead of a uniform. He doesn't wear the keffiyeh, the Arab headdress that Yasser Arafat always wore. And he's been quite clear about opposing this kind of violence. He is not a popular political figure. He's demonstrated very little skill in the past as a politician, another thing that makes him very different than Yasser Arafat. It's very unclear he's going to be able to deliver on his own stated goals.
So it sounds like Mahmoud Abbas, who's now the chair of the PLO, will be the main candidate for president of the Palestinian Authority, which governs the Gaza and the West Bank. What about the power plays behind the scenes? What kind of competition for power is happening there?
There's a tremendous amount of turmoil right now in the territories. You're seeing Palestinian politicians, militants, security officials all vying to either preserve their authority or increase their authority now that Yasser Arafat has left the scene. Yasser Arafat so dominated Palestinian politics that his really abrupt disappearance is suddenly causing all these guys to kind of look around and say, well, what next? And the people that were his loyalists are feeling vulnerable in a way they didn't before. The people who are glad to see him gone are seeing an opportunity to grab some more power. And the real problem, Terry, is that a lot of these guys have guns and they have followers who have guns. And there is a considerable risk of violence here. We've already seen a little bit of it. The Palestinian leadership has said, well, everybody's been predicting this kind of civil strife. It's in the interest of Israel to see it. Therefore, we're really going to make an effort to make this happen without any kind of violence. The person who is seen as causing it will be, they think, reviled by other Palestinians. But I think there's still a great risk of it.
So Mahmoud Abbas is now chair of the PLO. He's likely to run for president of the Palestinian Authority. What is the difference in function between those two positions? And if he wins the election, will he be both chair of the PLO and president of the Palestinian Authority?
Yes, he'll hold both those hats. He probably won't hold wear the third hat worn by Yasser Arafat, which was head of the dominant faction, Fatah. The PLO is the Palestinians' umbrella organization. It's composed of about 13 major factions. It does not include two big militant groups, Hamas and Islamic Jihad. But it is the overarching Palestinian organization. The Palestinian Authority is the institution created by the Oslo Accords with Israel in the 90s to govern Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. It's been dominated by Fatah, the main faction. The Fatah leadership has essentially been the same as the leadership of the Palestinian Authority up to now. But the PA, as it's called, has, at least on paper, a division, a functional division of government. There's a president, there's a Palestinian legislature, there's also a judiciary, which unfortunately is actually the weakest of the three legs of the stool. The legislature, while Hamas and Islamic Jihad will not contest the presidency, they may run for positions in the legislature once those elections are actually held.
As you mentioned, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, two very militant groups, said that they will not take part in the presidential election. They're going to boycott it. Does that mean that they're likely to try to disrupt the elections?
No, I don't think so. Both those groups, particularly Hamas, is quite disciplined about not letting itself be seen as a source of civil conflict. It's very important to Hamas that it be seen only as supporting the Palestinian cause, whatever that might be, never turning its rifles in any way on its own people. No, they're not likely to disrupt it. And as I said earlier, they're presenting it as a matter of principle that they're staying out of these elections. They don't want to run to be president of something that's a creature of an agreement with Israel. But there's very much a political reason for it, too. They're very happy being what they're known as among Palestinians, which is the opposition. They sit outside the government. They criticize the dominant faction, Fatah, as being corrupt. They criticize it for mismanaging the government. But I don't think they want to actually be in the position of having to deliver by trying to run this operation that really is responsible for providing services to the Palestinian people, picking up the trash, educating the kids, providing health care.
What are some of the difficulties the Palestinians are going to face in holding fair elections in the West Bank and Gaza?
There's a real logistical problem confronting the Palestinians as they try to hold these elections. They're under very sharp, tight travel restrictions now from Israel. The Israeli army is pervasive presence in the West Bank. It encircles a lot of these cities. Israel has said it has had to do this over the course of the conflict in order to stop suicide bombers from reaching Israel. So you're going to need to see a real level of coordination between the Palestinians and the Israelis for these elections even to take place. There's a further issue, which is the question of the status of East Jerusalem residents, Palestinians who live in East Jerusalem, whether or not they're going to be allowed to vote. The Palestinians are insisting that they should be able to vote as they were in previous elections in 1996. But some Israeli officials have said absolutely not. They don't want to establish any kind of new precedent that would suggest Palestinians have some sort of legitimate political presence in Jerusalem, which Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, among others, insists is Israel's eternal, indivisible capital. Now, interestingly, Mr. Sharon, in the last couple of days, has himself hinted that he might countenance the idea of Palestinians in East Jerusalem voting. And we'll see where the Bush administration comes out on this question.
Well, the Bush administration asked Sharon to consider removing Israeli security forces from Palestinian areas in order to facilitate the Palestinian elections. Do you think that Israel will continue its incursions into Gaza and the West Bank?
It depends on the circumstances. I think, yes, they will continue them almost certainly, but that doesn't mean that they won't be able to loosen restrictions sufficiently to allow the elections to go forward. I think everybody right now wants these elections to happen. Everybody recognizes how important they are in terms of legitimizing the new Palestinian leadership. And at least nobody wants to be seen as the obstacle to these elections taking place. And that's a very powerful force that I think everybody will be able to work with.
James Bennett of the New York Times speaking to us from Jerusalem. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by TIAA Cref, providing a wide selection of individual retirement solutions, tiaacref.org/radio, and from Harcourt, publishers of Tattoo for a Slave, a memoir in which New York writer Hortense Kalischer recalls her Jewish family's slave-owning history in the South. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what it was like to be in the crowd at Arafat's funeral after thousands of Palestinians tore down chain-link and barbed wire fences to get closer to his coffin. We continue our conversation with James Bennett of the New York Times. And Ken Tucker reviews Universal United House of Prayer, the new recording by Buddy Miller. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Bennett. After 3 years as the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief, he returned to the U.S. over the summer. But now he's back in the Middle East, where he's been covering the death of Arafat and its aftermath. This morning, Bennett went to a studio in Jerusalem to record our interview. The Bush administration said that the war in Iraq would help create a climate for peace in the Middle East, that if Saddam Hussein was gone and a democracy was created in Iraq, then democracy would spread through the region, and that would make a peace agreement between the Palestinians and the Israelis much more feasible. So far, what impact, if any, do you think what is happening in Iraq now and the instability in Iraq is actually having on the Middle East?
It's really striking how little relationship there seems to be with what's going on in Iraq and what's happening here. How little people here talk about it on either side, how little impression it seems to have made. Obviously, the images from Iraq are important here. Saddam Hussein used to contribute thousands of dollars to the families of suicide bombers. That money is now gone. There's more Muslim anger here against the United States, partly as a consequence of Iraq. And on the Israeli side, there's a certain, it's enhanced the feeling of solidarity with America, I would say, that they're seeing the Americans there. And there's also a certain grim satisfaction in seeing the Americans wrestle with their own occupation of an Arab people. But in general, I'd say there's been very little impact. I saw an Israeli intelligence officer who told me, look, we didn't really analyze Iraq as a threat before the war. We don't look at it as a threat now. It's simply not really relevant to what's going on here.
Yeah, there's two schools about Iraq and the Middle East. You know, one said that only after Saddam is gone and there's a democracy in Iraq can there really be peace in the Middle East. And another school says no real change happens in that whole region until the Palestinian state issue is resolved. From your position, having covered the Middle East for so long, what do you think of those perspectives?
Well, the Bush administration has never accepted the premise that the conflict here drives some of the anger in the Arab world against the United States, that it had anything to do with September 11th or any other Arab Muslim terrorism around the world, that it's simply an excuse. I think in either case, though, doing something about this conflict, that is, whether this is a motivating force or merely an excuse, doing something about it would take it off the table. That is, either as a source of motivation or as an excuse by Arab governments not to do things like to democratize, not to take other steps. They simply point at the conflict here and say it's too destabilizing. They're not able to make those sorts of aggressive moves in their own countries. Well, then the excuse would be gone if they were able to achieve some stability here. It's also true I also suspect that the test isn't even necessarily success. Bill Clinton didn't succeed here, but he tried awfully hard. And by trying, he gained, I thought, clearly gained a lot of credibility for the United States, not just here, but around the world, as being intent on productively trying to solve other people's problems. Now, Terry, I think we've talked about before, there's a question of democracy in the Arab world is obviously tremendously complicated one. The U.S. is now engaged in this extremely difficult effort to achieve it in Iraq. There is a case to be made that the Palestinians, the West Bank and Gaza are in a unique position to really embrace democracy. There are relatively few of them, 3.5 million or so. They've lived all over the world. They're a relatively literate and wealthy population because there's been so much international assistance here. They've got a very developed civil society, and they've had the experience of living next to Israel, which has led many Palestinian politicians to conclude that democracy is the way they want to go, that they resent Israel for denying their own rights, as they put it, but they really admire Israel's democracy and a kind of robust debate here, the freedom of the press, and they'd like to emulate that.
How do you think the death of Arafat and the upcoming election might affect Ariel Sharon's plan for a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza.
I think Ariel Sharon is intent on proceeding with that plan, regardless of who the Palestinian leadership is. He has set very clear tests that he expects any leader to meet. He wants to see a definite crackdown on terrorism, dismantling, as he puts it, the infrastructure of terror, putting these Hamas guys, Islamic Jihad people, and others in jail before he's willing to really start dealing with the leadership. I doubt that he will soften those demands. And in the meantime, I think he's going to proceed with his unilateral withdrawal. Now, certain Palestinian politicians are saying, fine with us, you know, go right ahead and proceed. We don't want to negotiate this withdrawal with you, but we want it to be the starting point for future negotiations. These people, and it's a fairly intelligent perspective, I think, are arguing that if they now put the Gaza withdrawal plan on the table, Sharon will seek to impose a million conditions before he'll do it. So they say, why not pocket it? Why not take it for free and then insist on other steps down the road?
Ariel Sharon's administration has been erecting a barrier around the West Bank that Sharon says is necessary for Israeli security. Palestinians say that it's walling them in, that it's almost making them prisoners in their homes. Do you think that this barrier is going to affect the ability of people to get around and vote? Because you've got the barrier, you've also got various roadblocks and checkpoints. So how is that going to affect the election?
Well, it depends how many polling places there are, how they're located. I think that the barrier itself probably won't be a huge obstacle to voting. I think they'll be able to figure out ways around it. And again, the question is whether the Israelis will let Palestinians across checkpoints in order to vote. I mean, for example, from the small villages outside Nablus, will they have to go into the city of Nablus in order to vote? The barrier is not an issue there, but the Israeli armor that encircles Nablus is, and there'll have to be some sort of provision for them to get back and forth, or else some sort of opportunity to vote outside, essentially in the countryside, which is much more thinly settled in those areas. But you've seen some interesting changes. I was in the town of Qalqilya a couple of days ago, which is in the central West Bank within sight of Tel Aviv, and it is totally encircled by the Israeli barrier. There's a concrete running along one side that's about 25 feet, 30 feet high, and guard towers. And then there's fencing in the other places. And what the Israelis have now done, Qalqilya was entirely cut off from a dozen or so villages nearby, but what the Israelis have now done is to dig essentially a series of underpasses under the barrier and under Israeli roads so that people can pass within the barrier from those villages into Qalqilya, move back and forth without crossing a checkpoint.
I imagine that gets a mixed reaction, and here's why. I mean, on the one hand, it makes getting through easier. On the other hand, it's this like illustration of a two-tiered society.
It's an astonishing thing when you see it. The reason Qalqilya is surrounded is that it sits, as I said, right on this right on the boundary between Israel and the West Bank. There are also some Israeli settlements within the West Bank very close to Qalqilya. So Israel says that it needs to protect those settlements by encircling Qalqilya. And they've now tried to solve this problem of cutting it off from the villages by digging what is in effect a tunnel. So the economy is improving a little bit in the city. People can now get in from the villages. They can now fairly easily reach Qalqilya, bring their produce for sale on the market, buy televisions and what have you in downtown Qalqilya. But at the same time, it is this, you look at it and you see the Israeli vehicles passing on the roads overhead, the Palestinians driving beneath them, within this fenced enclosure, and they're occupying just completely different dimensions of the same small space. It's just an amazing thing to see.
Well, one more question about Mahmoud Abbas. He opposes violent opposition to Israel. He opposes suicide bombings. Do you think that it is likely to be safer, that this is likely to be a safer period for Israelis, with Mahmoud Abbas as chair of the PLO and as the likely president of the Palestinian Authority?
The pattern of the last few years has been that whenever there was new hope for movement forward in the peace process here, when the Bush administration got more engaged, when Colin Powell came to visit, whenever those sorts of things happened, there was inevitably a spike in violence. There was more there were more suicide bombings, there were more shootings at Israelis on the road. Israel would respond with incursions into the Palestinian territories. What happens is that the militant groups who don't want to see a peace agreement with Israel, they don't want to see progress move forward, take this kind of thing as a challenge and do what they can to disrupt the process. And I'm afraid we may well see that again. Now, they're less able to do that than they used to be. It's much harder for militants to launch attacks against Israelis now, partly because of the new barrier, partly because the Israeli army is so pervasive, particularly in the West Bank, and partly because the Israelis have taken advantage of the massive arrest raids they've conducted in the last few years to build up an extraordinary intelligence network in the territories. And one final factor is that the Israelis have conducted this campaign of targeted killings against the leadership of these groups. So they're under tremendous pressure, and it's a lot harder for them to carry out these sorts of attacks. But I think, and I'm afraid, that we're going to see them try.
My guest is James Bennett, former New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief. He's now back in the Middle East. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Bennett, and he was the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief for 3 years. He left that position over the summer and is now a correspondent in the Times Washington bureau. But right now, he's back in the Middle East and has been reporting on the death of Arafat and its aftermath. You actually covered the funeral of Arafat. Can you describe where you positioned yourself and what it was like when thousands of people broke through the security fences?
It was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, the funeral. I was positioned in a building, a six-story building next to the Mukata, Arafat's compound, over the morning and into the afternoon, watching from an upper floor. And the building itself was partially overrun by gunmen over the course of the day, as these guys wanted to get their own good vantage point to watch the funeral. They began pouring into the building, climbing through the windows, and crowding in among the journalists who had secured positions earlier in the day. The Palestinian security was trying to push them out of the building. I stayed there over the course of the morning into the afternoon as the crowd built around the compound, and it was amazing to watch as initially people were held outside the walls. There was a security perimeter around within the wall. People started climbing on top of the wall. They found their way on top of the ruins of the compound itself. They gradually started moving in closer and closer to this vast paved area inside the compound where the burial site is, where the helicopters were supposed to land. And at a certain point, by midday, it just looked like the security was breaking down completely. People had crowded in onto that paved area. They were getting closer and closer, and it got hard to imagine how the helicopters would ever land and the burial would take place. Finally, in sort of mid-afternoon, a great whistling started going up from the crowd. We didn't know what it was at first. It turns out that somebody had spotted the helicopters. As a colleague of mine later observed, Palestinians have gotten very good at spotting helicopters at a great distance. And sure enough, these two gigantic yellow Egyptian helicopters came swooping in over the crowd, which parted beneath them, and somehow these Egyptian pilots managed to land them without hurting anybody. At that point, as soon as the helicopters touched down, I ran out of this building and into the compound and into the crowd, and I managed to get quite close as they loaded the coffin onto a truck, and they brought it through the crowd, cutting a channel through these thousands and thousands of Palestinians. It went right by me, and it was, men were sobbing, other men were emptying M16 clips, you know, against the sky. Tremendous tumult, women crying. I got into the room where Arafat was supposed to lie in state, but there were so crammed with people, they finally gave up on that. But I did find Yasser Arafat's mother-in-law in there, also in tears. And she told me that she'd just spoken to his daughter, who'd asked in French, is he really dead? And she said, yes, he, mon chéri, he's really dead. And she said, well, what's become of him now? And she assured her that that he'd become an angel in paradise.
How did you get through the crowds of people?
Just pushing and shoving, like everybody else. I mean, it was a tremendous smell of perspiration and spent gunpowder. You know, it was just shouting, pushing, all of us. And so, you know, we were all kind of shoving to get close to it. And I just joined the grand shoving match.
When you were in the middle of this incredible crowd of people, were you confident that it was going to be relatively peaceful?
And no, guys were already shooting. It was scary. It was scary and exhilarating and fascinating and also depressing at the same time. It was an astonishing kind of atmosphere of mourning and carnival and celebration. People were having a good time. Some were just in utter despair and sobbing, but others felt like it was this great kind of public celebration that they'd defeated the authority that was trying to keep them out of Yasser Arafat's burial and that they'd gotten to participate in it. It was, as many Palestinians there said, and as many Israelis would also say, I think, the funeral that Yasser Arafat deserved. They would mean different things by that, but I think they all drew the same conclusion. I think Israelis found it deeply disturbing. They watched this anarchy, these guns going off, and they wondered, who are these people?
You said that during the Arafat's funeral, a lot of people were firing their guns in the air. And I think that's a fairly standard thing in that part of the world at funerals as well as at celebrations. What happens to those bullets?
This is one of the enduring mysteries, at least of the Middle East. It's true that at all these funerals, there's a lot of gunfire in the air. Although the Palestinian Authority has passed laws against it, it continues. And at Yasser Arafat's funeral, there was a tremendous amount of gunfire. Israelis were making dark jokes about being pleased to see the Palestinians spend their bullets. And other people were wondering if this meant peace was really coming because people were willing to use up all their ammunition. I don't know. I saw guys shooting entire clips from their M16, popping the old one out while the shells were still clattering on the pavement and shoving a new one in and firing that one off too. And as far as I know, nobody got shot. Nobody was hit. But the bullets have to fall somewhere. And as I remember my own high school physics, conservation of force of energy would suggest they'd return to Earth with the same energy with which they left the gun. So it seems tremendously dangerous, but I guess the terrain over which they're distributed is large enough. They're said to be, when Arafat came back to Jericho in the mid-90s under Oslo, there was also a tremendous amount of celebratory shooting, and one guy was killed, I'm told, that day by a bullet that returned to Earth. But that's the only case that I know of or have been told of in which that happened.
Okay.
It was particularly scary, I might add, on the day of Arafat's burial, because a lot of people were in elevated positions. They were standing up on the wall, people were perched on top of light posts, and there were journalists doing live shots from the tops of the surrounding buildings. And a lot of these guys were firing on an angle, not straight up and down. So I was really worried about some of my colleagues, but everybody emerged unscathed.
Arafat had hoped to be buried in Jerusalem. The Israeli government denied him that, and he's buried in Ramallah. Do you think that this is likely to be negotiated in any future peace settlement, and that it's possible that his body would be moved to Jerusalem sometime in the future?
Well, presumably, if the Palestinians are ever able to get some sort of sovereign presence in Jerusalem, a portion of the city as their capital, and they had their own state, then they'd be perfectly within their rights, one would imagine, to move Arafat's body there. Some Palestinian officials said there are actually hooks on his coffin, in addition to the Jerusalem soil that was placed under it, so that it'll be easy to pick the coffin up and move it when that day comes. At the moment, it seems an awfully long way off. Arafat, in the end, people did say he had the burial he deserved, but his end is certainly not one I don't think that he would have wanted. He died far from Jerusalem, far from the Holy Land in general, in a Paris hospital after this kind of farcical battle between his wife and his aides. I don't think it's the end that he would have picked.
Thank you so much for talking with us again. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
James Bennett spent 3 years as the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief. He returned to the Middle East to cover Arafat's death and its aftermath. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. Bennett is now a correspondent in the New York Times Washington bureau. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by Buddy Miller, a guitarist and singer best known for his alt-country albums recorded with his wife Julie Miller. Now he has a solo album with a gospel tinge. This is Fresh Air. Buddy Miller's country songs have been covered by everyone from the Dixie Chicks to Brooks and Dunn. He's played guitar in Emmylou Harris's band for 8 years. Along with his wife, Julie Miller, they've carved out a career as admired cult artists. Miller has a new solo album called Universal United House of Prayer, which he's called his most personal record ever. And rock critic Ken Tucker says it's different from anything he's done before.
It's a demolition derby. It's the sport of the hunt. Proud tribe and full war dance. It's a slow smile that the bully gives the run. It's the force of inertia. It's the lack of constraint. It's the children out playing in the rock garden, all dialed up in black hats and war paint. Sometimes it feels like bars of steel. I cannot bend with my hands. Ooh, I worry too much. Somebody told me that I worry too much. Ooh, I worry too much. Somebody told me that I worry too much.
Buddy Miller may have a tendency, as he puts it in that song, to worry too much, but his worry doesn't have a deleterious effect on his music, quite the opposite. Miller's pensiveness, a habitual questioning of how he fits into the world, into his relationships, combines with an instinct to pare everything down to its essence. As far as music goes, that means writing and covering songs that feature stark guitar lines and easily howled choruses for his limited but very effective, appealing voice. The metaphors that he and his wife and musical partner Julie use most frequently tend to derive from their Christian faith, images of rivers and rocks, hellfire and ascension, inner doubt and torrents of passion.
Is that you, my Lord? Is that you, my Lord? Is that you, my Lord? That you, Lord, talking to my heart. I can hear a sound
over the water.
I can hear a sound
coming on the rain.
I can hear a sound
whisper on the wind.
It sounds like the Spirit calling out my name. It's calling to
Universal United House of Prayer, named for a church in Nashville, is distinctive from Miller's previous collections of non-establishment country music. Alt-country is the music biz term, but Miller isn't a biz type of guy. No, this album has more of a gospel feel. Much of that feeling is supplied by the choral voices of Regina and Ann McCrary, sisters whose father is the Reverend Sam McCrary, one of the founders of the great gospel group the Fairfield Four. It's one of Buddy Miller's gifts that he can take a piece of music by one of the whitest gospel duos in country music history, the Louvin Brothers, and add the McCrary sisters' African-American voices to create a galvanizing chunk of music.
When burdens seem to overcome,
there's a higher power
who's faithful and refuses none.
There's a higher power.
Then why ask men to help you through?
There's a higher power.
They're helpless pilgrims just like you.
There's a higher power.
Let's sing it, shout it, walk it, talk it. There's a higher power. Lay down your soul, cause Jesus brought it. There's a higher power.
Amen.
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 There's a higher power.
Amen.
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 There's a higher power.
I don't much like being preached to in my pop music and have little use for the often watery, pious stuff the industry calls contemporary Christian music. Fortunately, neither does Buddy Miller. His faith harks back to a time before singing about Jesus and professing a need to give oneself over to a higher power was hijacked by the politicized Christian right.
The earth can shake, the sky come down, the mountains all fall to the ground, but I will fear none of these things. Shelter me, Lord, underneath your wings. Dark waters rise and thunders pound. The wheels of war are going round, and all the walls are crumbling. Shelter me,
to know where Miller stands, you can listen to his dirge-like cover of Bob Dylan's With God on Our Side, with its withering contempt for war makers. It's a song Miller has taken to doing in concert since the onset of the Iraq War, but as far as the album goes, he didn't even need it. It's so good, it transcends politics, religion, or the genre pigeonholing of country or gospel to become, well, to become transcendent.
Ken Tucker is the film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Universal United House of Prayer by Buddy Miller. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lord John and the Private Matter, the first Lord John Gray novel by Diana Gabaldon, author of Outlander. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It would be difficult to come from a more dysfunctional background than Augustine Burroughs, but he's turned his messy, troubled coming of age into a series of amusing, best-selling memoirs, Running with Scissors, Dry, and his latest, Magical Thinking. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Burroughs about his life and writing. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.